morning, everybody. Matt Pavile here with you on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue in the historic Tribune Tower building, where we will not be for much longer. We're moving, I think, in April, Raj, right?
It's springtime, yeah. I'm not sure the exact month.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. We're going south on Michigan Avenue across the river to the
Illinois Center.
Which is a wonderful building. I interned there in college at Fox 32.
Yeah.
I interned for Bruce Wolf back in the day.
Really?
I did.
Good old Bruce.
I did.
And interviewed me once.
While Bruce is insanely crazy politically, he was a good guy. Yeah. Mad, raving lunatic, that man. However, I really enjoyed working for him. He was really good to me. And I remember it was actually the summer I interned was the summer that Michael Jordan's dad went missing.
No.
And then turned up murdered. Yeah.
Wow, that was a huge story.
That was a huge story. That was crazy.
Yeah, he was robbed. Supposedly, I mean, that's...
And I don't remember now because it's so long.
He was driving and someone got robbed.
From what I remember at the time, and I have not read this story in a long time,
yeah.
So I haven't... although I do remember that I think it was two young men who ended up getting convicted.
Yeah.
I want to say one of them just appealed recently something.
Ooh.
And I don't know how you appeal 20 years later, but
yeah,
I believe
right.
There was something like that. But from what I understand, what I remember at the time, at first his dad was missing... And it wasn't that big of a deal. They had waited a while to say something because his dad would just take off in the car sometimes and go travel a little bit. And so it wasn't completely out of the ordinary, as I remember, for dad to be gone for a couple days. But this had now been like over a week or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the story that came out at the time was he had pulled over somewhere and was sleeping in the car.
He was returning from a funeral. In 1993, July of 1993,
librarian.
8 days before his 57th birthday, he pulled over on U.S. Highway 74 just south of Lumberton, North Carolina, to take a nap. You're right. And then those two spotted the car.
Probably a really nice car. I want to say it was a Lexus.
It was a red Lexus Michael had just bought for him. The two shot him to death while he slept in the car, stole the vehicle. Body was found August 3rd in a swamp in South Carolina, and it took a while before they could identify it through dental records. Then the two apparently realized who it was. They'd taken other items, including two NBA championship rings given to Jordan Sr. by Michael. They made several calls from Jordan's cell phone. They were immediately captured.
So they weren't very smart.
No.
Which isn't surprising.
Let's see.
But yeah, that was
in 2010. The case was one of nearly 200 that were in review. They found that lab techs mishandled or omitted evidence. However, the Jordan case was later removed from that list. That's the latest I got on it.
So that was 93.
Yeah.
Summer of 93.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say Jordan does not play the next year, right? Did they win 91, 92, 93,
when he went into
didn't
baseball?
Win 94, 95, and then won 96, 97, 98?
No, right? They won three in a row and then
right, I
lost.
Believe, 91, 92,
oh, okay.
93.
Okay.
I think
but then
this,
he went into baseball.
Well, like, yeah, a little while later, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, did the White Sox make the playoffs in 93?
Let me double check.
Librarian Roger Dreamster, okay. We'll look that up real quick for us.
White Sox playoff. White Sox playoffs. I don't want... What? No. White Sox postseason results through the history. What did you say, 93?
1993, the summer of this
1993
happened.
AL Championship Series against okay. Toronto. They lost two games to four.
Because I remember that Michael Jordan's retirement
mm-hmm.
leaked out during a White Sox playoff game.
Ooh.
That's when the rumors started picking up. I don't remember if it was said on a broadcast that night or if Jordan was at the game or what happened. I think the next day, I want to say, he announced he was retiring and was not going to play
that season.
He
abruptly retired from basketball before the beginning of the 93-94 NBA series, started a new career playing minor league baseball. He returned in March of 95.
And then they won 96-97, 98.
Right.
So 93, I intern at Fox 32 News. We've got that story.
Mm-hmm.
94, I graduate from college and move out to Los Angeles.
Ooh.
And then in 95, I'm working at a LA radio station during the OJ trial.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look at, geez, and I thought I had an exciting life.
I got to be around a couple interesting things.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. Bad events, but cool to be involved. Cool to, when you're a news person or working in the media, it's very exciting to be around those things. The most terrible events are the most, I don't know, enthralling days of your work
life. Not it's why terrible. You got into the news business or into broadcasting, but it's what makes...
It's the response that's required in times like that. One of my greatest memories of working here, even though it's a bad event, was when the space shuttle crashed over Texas.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't working. It was a Saturday morning. I had produced John Williams on Saturdays for a long time. Then John quit doing the Saturday show, and Steve Bertrand started doing it. And then I left. I was actually, this is before I started Black Dog, but I was producing Steve Dale's previous national syndicated pet show, Animal Planet Radio. So I'd be here on Saturday mornings for a little bit, and then I'd head over to the studios where that was done. And I was here when that happened, and Beth Swerk was producing for Steve.
Oh, yeah.
And Beth had relatively recently, I think, taken over the Saturday stuff. I don't think she had Kathy and Judy yet. I think Kurt was still doing Kathy and Judy. Okay. So Beth was still relatively newer as a producer. And so this happened, and she'd never had to deal with something like that before. And so I stayed here and helped make calls and stuff. And we were able, before Steve got off the air, to get somebody on who had witnessed debris coming down in Texas. And that was like... As terrible as that is, that's one of those moments that you're like, we really did some exciting, you know, work that day.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't here when on 9/11 in the morning, but I was here in the afternoon. I was here the next morning after Bob Collins passed away, things like that. And those are all very busy times, but it's those busy breaking news moments. I also remember the election of George W. Bush over Gore. And being here and how that
with
day.
With the hanging chads.
Well, and that day, I remember chatting with Steve Bertrand that day because all the indications were that, or maybe it's more the Kerry one. I don't remember because then Bush ran for re-election against John Kerry, right? I can't remember which one. All the indications were that Bush was going to lose. And I remember talking about that off the air, that what's going to happen tonight. And then when it went so differently, how just... interesting and exciting that is.
Sure.
And I remember, I think I texted Steve Bertrand this year, or last year it would have been, on Election Day saying, because everybody's thinking Hillary's going to win this thing.
Right.
And I think I texted Steve Bertrand and said, this feels an awful lot like for like that one, you know, like everybody thinks it's going one way. Is it really going to go that way?
Yeah. Next this is another Truman. You know.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it's... I don't know why. Rick Hogan has interviewed me, I think, about three times now on my life because he thought that it turned out that almost every week one of the people he would have on, I knew from somewhere.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. From it could have been as recent as the last year to maybe 20, 30 years ago. Or we had some sort of connection. And so he started interviewing me, and it's been a little while, but... he, first of all, he's a great interviewer, and he is so interested in stuff that I find very ordinary. You know, it's like you're saying.
Well, it's the newsman in him. He finds the, you know, interesting what's ordinary to the rest.
Yeah, and I don't know. He keeps saying that I'm the Zelig of...
Nobody makes you feel better about what you do than Rick Hogan.
Yeah, he's...
Roger Treemstra, you've been you've been in the news for 100 years now, and it's amazing what you do. Everybody interviews. He's very amazed at how good they are.
He's so interested in your story. Yeah. And
he's a good guy. Yeah. Rick is a really good guy. I haven't seen Rick in forever. I did not see... Where were you at the Christmas party today?
Because I work all night, I was sleeping and taking care of the dog.
That's no excuse. It's the Christmas party, Roger.
Plus, I also knew that I was going to have to come in early anyway, and I needed to take a nap, so I took one earlier in the day, I had to come in early anyway because Patty had sent me a note saying she was showing White Christmas with the Marines at 6 o'clock, and we finally got to it about, I don't know, almost 7. But, yeah, I warned her that I was going to have to bring Kleenex, and I did.
You cried during White Christmas?
Oh, my God. Every time I see it, I cry, and I can tell you exactly when.
I don't know. Have I never seen White Christmas? I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know if I have. Wait, what happens in White? Give me the general.
Over. Well, it starts in the military, World War II.
Okay.
And there are these two entertainers, Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye. Actually, Bing Crosby is the big name entertainer. Danny Kaye is just a soldier, happens to be, appearing with him, kind of like a USO show.
Okay.
At the front. And bombs blowing her up all over. Then the general who's in charge of their division is being replaced by this really not so nice general. And so they put on the show, but then a bombing raid starts blowing up things around them. And Danny Kaye saves, even though it's kind of stretched out, and I use the air quotes on that, saves Bing Crosby. And injures his arm, which he keeps using to get Bing Crosby to do certain things.
Okay.
Such as become his partner when the war ends, and they go on to be a BAFO act that kind of, rules Broadway and Hollywood with their stage shows. And this goes on for a number of years. Then these two girls, Vera Ellen, who I had a crush on, back in the day.
Okay.
But she's really thin, kind of anorexic. George Clooney's aunt, Rosemary Clooney, play two sisters of one of their old army buddies. One of the sisters, Vera Ellen, tricks them into coming to see their show. They end up on a train together going to Vermont. Which is not where the two guys wanted to go. They wanted to go to New York. The girls had to go to Vermont to appear at a resort, a ski resort. And so they end up going up there thinking it's going to be snowy and cold and it'll be good for all of them. And there's this love interest, Vera Ellen and Danny Kaye and Rosemary Clooney and Bing Crosby, even though that one's in and out and in and out, kind of troubled, and it tears at the heartstrings at the end. So they get to Vermont, and there's no snow. And they're getting ready to leave, and in walks the proprietor of the inn, who happens to be... No guess?
Fred Astaire?
Wrong.
Oh. I don't know.
The general, who is carrying wood and acting like he's the janitor, but he has bought the place, but they're going broke.
Okay.
And so they have this...
They put on a big show, right?
They bring their show.
I think I've seen some of this.
Right. And they bring the show up, and then they realize that, that they need to show this general that he's not forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bring in as many of the former troop, the division, mm-hmm. the soldiers... up for a big holiday show for the general. The general's family hides all of his suits except his uniform. They send him out to the cleaners, so he can't go down unless he wears the uniform. That's crying spot number one, when he starts walking down the stairs and his granddaughter sees him. That's the first grab of the Kleenex.
Okay.
Then... They walk into, he and his granddaughter walk into the showroom, restaurant, lounge, whatever. And that's number two, because the spotlights come on and the soldiers all yell, "Ten hut." Oh, I'm crying already. Stop. Seriously. Then it starts snowing. Just in time for them to sing White Christmas. Well, unbeknownst to Bing Crosby, Rosemary Clooney, who had quit the show and gone to New York to perform by herself, mm-hmm. has seen the broadcast that Crosby did trying to get the soldiers to come in. He did a TV broadcast.
Okay.
And she has forgiven him now for all the misconceptions she had about his what she thought were his angles, And she sneaks back in, and she suddenly is in the show, and they make up and kiss, and Danny Kaye and Vera Ellen hug and kiss, and everyone's singing White Christmas, and they open up the barn doors to the snow, and all the soldiers are standing with their families. And that's crying boy number two.
That's three.
Three. Stop it.
All right, we're going to let Roger compose himself before the 2:30 headlines. He's got his head buried on the broadcast table upstairs now, so we'll take this short commercial break, and then Roger Banish will have your 2:30 a.m. news, sans tears. Unless it starts snowing during the broadcast. In which case,
we'll open up the barn doors.
Roger, we always have to tell you, keep that barn door closed. Matt Bubala with you here, 720 WGN. 2:39 in the morning. We're here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in the Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. The Winter Olympics are February 9th through the 25th in South Korea, in Pyeongchang, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Somebody who could tell us if we are or not is Andrew Wittenberg. He's a news anchor and reporter out of Utah who covered the Rio Olympics, and he is headed to South Korea pretty soon. Good morning, Andrew. How are you?
Hey, good morning. How's it going, Matt?
It's good. Thanks for jumping on with us. We appreciate it. Always nice to meet a new friend.
Anytime.
So,
yes, indeed.
Let's talk Olympics a little bit. The Winter Olympics are my favorite Olympics. If we have a battle between summer and winter, and I know almost nobody who agrees with me on this, but I enjoy the winter so much more. I feel like fewer events, more watchable events, quite honestly. I even watch the curling, which is ridiculous, but I do. And I think they're just much more enjoyable. What's your take on the Olympics?
I know people here in Utah specifically love the Olympics as a host city.
Sure.
Back in 2002, people just eat it up, summer or winter. But especially in the winter, I mean, I think it's different. It's outside of the major four sports in the U.S. And so it's something that is not what you see growing up as much for much of the United States. And so people love it. Maybe just a little bit different, something, yeah, you don't see every day. So
yeah.
I think that may be some of the allure behind it.
That is a nice thing about it. So since you're paying attention to things, let's talk a little bit about, am I pronouncing it right? Is it Pyeongchang?
Yeah, there was even a little bit of, sort of confusion even in recent months, whether it was going to be Pyeongchang or Pyeongchang. And I think the official American pronunciation is actually Pyeongchang. So, yeah, okay. We're going with that for February.
Pyeongchang. And one of the questions that always becomes a topic as we get close to the Olympics, and we're now 54 days away from the start of these Olympics, is how ready is the venue? Because a lot of times we have, I know in Sochi there were big issues with they're still finishing the buildings and everything's not ready, and even though they had years and years to get this ready, it's such an expensive endeavor. A lot of times countries end up a little bit behind. How prepared is South Korea for these Olympics?
Well, this is a drastic departure from what we even saw in Rio just, 18 months ago or so, or a little less than 2 years ago. But the Olympic venues, as far as we have been told, are either completely done or very close to it. In fact, most of the venues have already had test events this winter, and even going back to last winter, some venues had test events. So this is much different than what we've seen in the past two Olympic cycles where it appears as though everything is on track, everything's ready to go, and that's a little bit of a nice thing, especially with Rio and Sochi, where there had been so many concerns about those venues being done, and like you mentioned, in some cases, I think they're still being built, but
yeah.
It looks like everything's pretty much ready to go.
And how are the security issues? We've got the North Korea situation that's been quite a topic the past year, and South Korea's, stuck in the middle of all that. What are the concerns as we head into these Olympics?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest concern is the political situation, obviously going on between North Korea, everything on the Korean Peninsula, between the South Koreans, the Japanese have been in the headlines. And then, of course, our situation in the United States, where there's been a lot of tough language between two leaders of countries. And, I mean, it's it's certainly, I think, the highlighting security concern. But what we've been told through our folks who are heading this up is that, you know, this is something that the South Koreans have dealt with for 70 years, are these threats and being so very close to an extremely tense situation. And Pyeongchang, some of the mountain venues are in some instances less than 50 miles away from the DMZ, the demilitarized zone there along that border with North Korea. And so, you're talking about some pretty close proximity to some pretty tense stuff. But they say they've dealt with this before. In fact, not something that is actually too different security-wise than what we saw here in Salt Lake in 2002, which came on the heels of 9/11, where there was a tremendous security, where there was a lot of anxiety about what could happen, what would happen, and ultimately the games went off without a hitch. And so that's what they're hoping to, have here again, is that, there's been a lot of buildup, but that the Olympics are something that bring people together. That term that you always hear news folks say, cautiously optimistic, I guess.
Yeah, when we refer to the 2002 Utah Olympics, I think two very similar yet very different situations, right? Because that was in the U.S., within the U.S., without any other borders close by that would be concerning. I know that you're bringing a lot of people from foreign countries in, so there's that, and the threat of a small-time terrorist act at an Olympic venue is scary. Here, it seems like the concern would be a little more, not that there's going to be some sort of lone wolf incident, but you've got this big, bad dictatorship, as you said, not too far away. I mean, only 50 miles away, we worry about hydrogen bomb testing, but they could send small-time rockets 50 miles away if they really wanted to cause a problem. I think the general consensus is they're not going to do something like that. But you do wonder if Kim Jong-un is going to try to rattle the world by doing something while the Olympics is going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're spot on with what the fear is, and that's worst-case scenario. But, we just heard, I think this week or maybe 10 days ago or something, in that span that, there's 5,000 security officers. They don't have any sort of indication. The defense systems in South Korea are tremendous. What we've heard about, especially in conjunction with the United States recently, with some of the military drills that they do annually and have for decades there. So, our understanding is that everything is as prepared for as possible, and that every sort of plan B is in place should something happen. But again, the thought is that the Olympics bring the world together and, shouldn't be lost on the fact that North Korea participates in the Olympics. They participated in Rio, and all indications are that they will have their delegation, albeit small, in Pyeongchang as well.
So they do have a delegation. You said, albeit small, is it like 50 people or less? I would imagine it is relatively small, right?
Yeah, I'm sure it's less than that. Yeah, it's funny, sort of a side note. I was in Rio in 2016, and we actually were leaving the Rio airport. I remember distinctly, like this was yesterday, we were actually getting food in a food court in the Rio airport, and we saw the Republic of Korea, uniforms, the I believe it's the DPKs or the DRK or whatever the initials are, and you see them walk by in a very sort of odd, manner, sitting in a food court like you might be in any other major airport in the world, and here come the North Korean athletes just walking by, heading on a flight back to North Korea. So, I would say it's probably less than perhaps even a dozen or something. I want to say we saw something in the area of maybe less than 10 athletes in the summer games, which there are a lot more athletes. So I would say, probably a handful. They compete just like a lot of other countries around the world.
I wonder what the restrictions on them are, because there'd be a concern, I would imagine. Any athletes they send into South Korea might want to stay in South Korea and not go back.
Right.
Or have you heard at all about how that delegation is? Are they treated so well because they're athletes that it's easy for them to go back home? It's unlikely they'd want to leave, or they'd be scared maybe of what would happen to their family if they didn't return home?
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty. I remember we had that very conversation, like, what do you do if you're a North Korean athlete and you're going halfway around the world in so many instances where North Koreans have been precluded from being able to even leave the borders of North Korea on a regular basis, you know, to be frank with you, I don't know what that pressure is like. I can only imagine the security and sort of the keeping in line of those athletes has got to be tremendous. Yeah, I mean, we saw that in the airport. I mean, just security around them, and like it was sort of surreal almost in a sense, because obviously there's been tension with North Korea for decades. To see them in a very public scenario like that is something different. But I can only imagine there's probably intense scrutiny. There's probably, you know, a sense of even national pride. I don't know. But I would venture a guess to say that they probably don't take much of a chance on athletes who they think might defect or something like that. Yeah. That would be my best guess.
Yeah, I imagine they don't want to lose anybody, but also just the black eye that would be. I'm sure the public relations of that would be very unsettling for Kim Jong-un. And what do you make of Russia being banned from these Olympics because of systematic doping, not only allegations, but a lot more than allegations, if they've banned almost the entire Russian delegation? I know that certain athletes can apply if they can prove that they haven't been involved, but they'd have to participate with no country affiliation, which is kind of very interesting. I know that's happened at the Olympics before, but that's such a weird sight. And for Russia to be the ones getting accused of that, I imagine Vladimir Putin isn't happy about that, although I believe I've heard and read that he will allow athletes to participate if they can get accepted by the Olympic Committee. I'm kind of surprised by that. What's your take on what's going on with the Russia situation?
Yeah, that was also news this past week or so, that they would be able to participate under the neutral flag, and they would be an Olympic athlete from Russia, not a Russian athlete. They won't wear Russian uniforms. They won't have the Russian national anthem played at the podium if they should win a medal. And that's, you know, an interesting development for sure. We heard about it, you know, really starting in Sochi and the immediate aftermath of those games, that there could have been some concerns with doping. And then, you know, to have this situation, you had, I think it's six or four, I believe six female hockey players from Russia that have been banned for life from the Olympics this past week. And so, yeah, that's a huge story. Now, I mean, what does that mean long term? I think the IOC still has a lot to go through. This kind of caught a lot of people, not to say off guard, but it definitely was a surprise to have this happen, you know, within 2 months of the Olympics, I think. But, yeah, it's a turn of events. Again, I think it showcases just that, you know, the Olympics are sort of a kind of event that sort of transcends politics in a way. I mean, it seems like every cycle we've had something, whether it was Zika before Rio or the political unrest before Sochi, the past few cycles. And in this instance, it looks like they're trying to get it right, the Russians, by allowing their athletes to compete. Because, again, these athletes are, as you guys know, I mean, people that have dedicated their lives, their money, and oftentimes their families' lives to be able to train for one moment. You know, I think if you can draw a positive from it, that is positive, that it seems like the Russian delegation is going to allow them to compete. However, you know, still quite the black eye that they've been implicated in something so wide ranging that it appears as though this has been ongoing for years, and that it was well known and in some cases approved through the Russian Olympic Federation. And so, yeah, there will be a lot of fallout, I think. Probably a lot of scrutiny and a lot of drug testing going on as well in the days leading up to those games.
Well, and Andrew, I don't remember hearing a lot from Putin other than that he's going to allow these athletes to try to participate. I'm surprised he hasn't been fighting back and saying this is false or fake news, or, you know, that this isn't real, that we're being railroaded, something like that. Has the Russian delegation pretty much accepted this ruling and kind of acknowledged, okay, we're going to clean this up?
Yeah, the language that we heard over the past week, again, was something along the lines of, yeah, well, we don't agree with what you found, the IOC, but all right, we're going to accept your ruling. So a little curious, as always. Again, you know, similar to the North Korea situation, you don't get a lot of direct communication. You hear a lot of sort of back channel, I guess, sort of information. You know, they said they were going to fight some of it, but being so close to an Olympic period, that they were going to move forward with what the IOC was suggesting. Yeah, I don't know what that means. It's kind of interesting that you didn't hear some bombastic retort from Putin saying, this is ridiculous, this is preposterous. But I think going under the assumption that They can compete as an Olympic athlete from Russia rather than going completely, like we've seen in the past when refugees have competed under the Olympic flag, they simply don't have a country. In this instance, you know, there'll be an Olympic athlete from Russia. You just won't hear the Russian national anthem played during a medal ceremony. You know, some differences between the uniforms perhaps as well.
Yeah.
It's pretty curious that you didn't hear some major retort, because that seems to be Vladimir Putin's reaction to everything.
Right.
You know, how could this possibly have happened, et cetera, et cetera. So curious indeed, but, you know, I mean, you kind of scratch your head like you do maybe a lot of other things.
Well, and if you heard it all, I would imagine that heads are rolling in Russia over this, that either he's up, one of two things is Putin's upset that they were cheating so much and he didn't realize it, which is unlikely, or he's really upset that they you know, this all came out and they got caught in this way. So you got to imagine, maybe we're not hearing about it, but you got to imagine some people are in a lot of trouble over there, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and rightfully so. I mean, if this was something that was rampant throughout their federation, which it appears it was, at least on a degree of, you know, within their ranks. Now, I mean, how far does it go outside of their Olympic, you know, federation? Who knows? But yeah, I mean, certainly you'd think that heads are rolling there. And you know, you got to think about it too. I saw some interesting stuff on social media over this past week of people who came in fourth place behind a Russian, and they were sort of unceremoniously given a bronze medal because of the retraction from what happened in Sochi. And what happened in Rio, they took away a lot of those medals that Russians had won. And, you know, the athletes that competed that actually finished in the top three, they get a medal in the mail or something. You know, FedEx comes and delivers your Olympic medal a couple of weeks later. It's not exactly a great sign for Russia. And it sort of takes away a moment from an athlete who is rightfully deserving of a medal.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think there's probably a lot of head rolling. And I think they'll take a long look at moving forward. You know, this is the cycle from summer to winter. It's a little bit shorter than it is from winter to summer, because we'll now have until August 2020 before the games in Tokyo. And so I think there's going to be more to come out of this from the IOC. But again, you know, maybe caught a bit flat-footed with this ruling coming just, you know, like you said, 58, I think, at the time, you know, within certainly 2 months of the games.
Andrew Wittenberg is a reporter and news anchor in Utah. Hold on 1 second, Andrew. I don't know if he can stick around a little bit. Just talk to him off the air, because we got to take a quick break and do the 3 o'clock news. I would love to talk about the U.S. saying they might not be involved in the next one. We'll see if Andrew can hold on for a couple of minutes here and talk a little more. 720 WGN. Andrew Wittenberg, the news anchor and reporter from KSL in Utah, will join us again after the news. Talk a little bit more about the Olympics. What about the U.S. sort of saying, well, we're not sure if we're going yet, and there'll be no NHL players this time around for the first time in a long time. We'll talk about that. The news now at 3 a.m. with Roger Badish. Thank you, Roger. Matt Babal here with you on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Showcase studio, we're speaking with Andrew Wittenberg of KSL. He's a news anchor and reporter in Utah. And he is going to be in Pyeongchang, South Korea, for the Olympics coming up in about 50 days you'll have there. Do you get to go there a few days before the Olympics start, Andrew?
Yeah, well, I think it's February 2nd when we leave, and we get back on the 27th after a couple days after the closing ceremony. So, yeah, it's a long trip, but yeah, 50 some odd days away until we get back in action.
3 full weeks in South Korea. So let me ask you, because you've been to Olympics before, South Korea, I don't know how adventurous of an eater you are, but I imagine it's not like American food mostly when you're over there. But when you are at an Olympic event and it's such an international delegation, how much do they try to cater to that, or is it incumbent on you to be real adaptable to the environment that you're in?
Well, thankfully, I'm a pretty adventurous eater, so I'm pretty pumped about it, actually. Korean food is awesome. In fact, I'm doing a couple of stories this next week for KSL about some Korean restaurants here in Salt Lake to kind of get people acquainted with the idea of what you can eat beyond kimchi and Korean barbecue, you know, what you might have heard of. But yeah, that's nice. You know, the great thing with going through NBC, you know, it's like an army that good travels for NBC for the Olympics and, you know, North American coverage of the games. And so we actually have like a sort of cafeteria kind of thing. So, you know, thankfully, if you want it, you can get pizza and fries just like you can in anywhere else. You know, it's not quite Chicago-style deep dish or anything. But,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, you'll little comforts of home. If you want some chicken nuggets, you can grab those.
Yeah, I guess you really are lucky to work for NBC because I'm guessing the affiliates for ABC and CBS aren't necessarily sending somebody to the Olympics because it's got to be weird for the other networks because NBC, you know, is the exclusive broadcaster of it. So while they follow the Olympics, they don't want to give too much publicity to the Olympics, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's like a double-edged sword for a lot of media organizations because you'll see, I mean, you'll see all of the networks will be there. But I must say, you know, I mean, going to Rio was my first Olympics to cover in 16. And, you know, you see sort of the ESPN folks and all of the major networks and stuff that are normally traditionally the powerhouses of a sports product. They're sort of on the outside looking in.
Yeah.
All of the varying, you know, rights holders and all that sort of stuff. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic for sure with regard to like media and how it all plays out and who has what kind of access. It's for sure very interesting if you like that sort of thing.
Is it going to be weird for you to be at an Olympics that Bob Costas is not at?
Yeah, no kidding. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
I mean, this will be really interesting. Now, first of all, you got to say Mike Tirico is one of the best in our business.
Sure.
So he's going to do great in prime time. But yeah, I mean, sort of an odd passing of the torch. And, you know, I know Chicago and Cubs fans have an interesting relationship with Bob Costas being a St. Louis guy. But, you know.
Yeah, but he's no Joe Buck. It's not like we have issues with Bob Costas here in town. It's just, Joe Buck is the one who can't really walk through town very easily, I think.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, or much less Jack Buck, you know, back in the day,
yes.
Right? In the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But, yeah, no, it's an interesting time for sure. I mean, I think the face of broadcasting is changing, as you guys probably know very well. The actual just the way things are covered, the amount that they're covered, the social media presence, it's a very different world and it seemingly changes. And so this is going to be an interesting Olympic cycle where we see a very tangible face that is changing for primetime Olympics here in the U.S. I mean, it's been Costas since, I think, 92 in Barcelona.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a whole generation of kids who only have watched the Olympics with Bob Costas.
I mean, not even kids. I mean, I don't remember who was hosting primetime Olympic coverage. You know, I'm 35 years old. I don't remember who was hosting it before Bob Costas.
And I don't either.
For that matter, too, you know, to not see Matt Lauer there with the Today Show. He's been covering Olympics since 96 in Atlanta. Yeah. I mean, this is a different time, and that for an altogether different reason. But for sure, I mean, this is a different look, a different, you know, sort of optics behind the actual face of broadcasting for NBC.
And I imagine things have been planned for quite some time. Is the Today Show, usually NBC pulls out all the stops, wants to send as many people there as they can. You guys pay an insane amount of money for this, so you know, do whatever you can out there. I imagine the Today Show is planning to broadcast from there, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a big deal. In Rio, they were on the Copacabana beach for the Today Show, which was really cool to see. And, you know, I'm a morning guy. You know, I'm kind of, you know, in that cycle. So we usually try to embed with the Today Show for a couple of days and see what everything's going on over there. And they always have a lot of great guests and stuff. And so we'll go over and do a couple of days with the Today Show and the whole gang there. So, yeah, they'll have a big setup, I'm sure, once again. And you know, it's kind of nice, you know, working here in Salt Lake, and there is such a fever about Olympics and about that just industry that people are really interested in it, and they respond well to all the coverage. And we send being a host market, a lot of folks. We will have a cast and crew of five just from Salt Lake that will go through, you know, NBC, and we'll have coverage around the clock as well.
All right, so let's talk for a minute about this. So Russia's not going, although their athletes can. A listener had called and said that he believes that the whole drug issue started for Russia after 2010 when Putin was getting upset about how Russia was performing at the Olympics, that there was pressure put on the Olympic delegation to start performing better, and maybe that's where a lot of this came from. I was just reading a story while we were in the break about Putin, and he announced that he would be running for re-election the day after this ban came down, and he did make a comment about it oh God, where was it? It's just in this New York Times article. What he said about it was he did kind of dismiss it as politicizing, and you know, he did deride it a little bit. And he quote, absolutely staged and politically motivated decision is what he said. So as we go into Russia's not going to be there, some athletes can be there. But then I believe it was Nikki Haley at the UN a few days later said the U.S. hasn't fully decided, or something along the lines of the U.S. will be reviewing or deciding if we will send our delegation, which I thought was a very odd comment because we had heard nothing about any concerns the U.S. had had. And then suddenly once Russia's, you know, there's a lot of people who would conspiracy theorize this because of the whole collusion investigation, and suddenly Russia gets banned, and then somebody from the U.S. is saying, well, we're not sure if we're going. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of out of the blue as well, and believe me, that caught us off guard when Nikki Haley said that, U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Donald Trump had been asked, I think, a couple days before that in like a press gaggle. It wasn't even like any sort of press conference, but had been just kind of asked off the cuff at an event, hey, what's going on? Are you going to send U.S. athletes to South Korea for the Olympics? And it may have been on the heels of some North Korea questioning or something. And he kind of said, we'll take a look at it. And then Nikki Haley came out with that statement that says, we'll review it. And we'll, you know, and I mean, I can't imagine that there was a lot to that, because while there is, and oddly enough, there has been some pretty significant concerns in recent Olympics, you know, with Sochi and the Russian tension, then with Zika before the games in Rio.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, I think skepticism in some regard, but also it has thankfully wound up being relatively small in comparison to what actually happens, you know, between the lines on these competitive events. And so it's kind of, it was a head scratcher, quite frankly. And then, you know, they came out, I think, the next day after Nikki Haley's statements and said, all right, yeah, we're going to send a delegation. Everything's fine. Everybody calm down. But, yeah, certainly curious as to the timing. And I think, again, that's what we talk about a lot, you know, of course, is timing with all of these comments, and what in the world, you know, facilitates these comments at a particular time. You know, that's what's maybe more curious than anything, because certainly, you know, if something were to happen with regard to North Korea, they would probably look at making some changes, or probably look at figuring out what they were going to do, if anything, if they were going to pull back a delegation and not send one. But, yeah, I mean, that's just sort of odd, wasn't it? And so, you know, they came out the next day after that and said, well, yeah, I mean, we're still planning. And the U.S. Olympic Committee came out and said, well, and it seemed like they were caught off guard as much as anybody. Like, yeah, we're planning on sending everybody. Like, everything's in motion. Because, I mean, you got to think, with regard to nutritionists and advanced people, the U.S. delegation will go out there weeks ahead of time.
Sure.
You know, probably right after Christmas to get everything set up, to work on some of the training. You know, I know, for instance, we've got the U.S. Speed Skating World Championships here in Salt Lake this weekend. And then after that, I mean, it's kind of, you know, that's a lot of the Olympic spots are going to be taken this weekend here in Salt Lake. And beyond that, then they're all eyes on South Korea. And so I know one of the guys who won a gold medal here in Salt Lake, Derek Para, was a household name for a time in the speed skating world and was one of the faces of our Olympics. Yeah, he's going to be over there weeks in advance. So I don't know that there was a lot of consultation with those comments, because there will be a lot of folks getting pretty close to heading out of town after Christmas and the first of the year.
And what about the NHL players not participating? Is that going to affect the games much? I know that the hockey isn't the largest draw in the Olympics. It was probably more beneficial for the NHL than the Olympics itself to have NHL players, although maybe that would be debated who benefited more from that. But now we're going back to amateurs, at least as far as, I guess, the American and Canadian teams. What do you expect to see from the hockey?
Oh, you know, I mean, that's, I mean, for a guy that, you know, like myself, I'm a hockey fan, and, you know, not to, you know, put down all the Hawks fans there in Chicago and everywhere else, but, you know, I grew up in Nashville, a Preds fan, and, you know, yeah. It's almost a shame in a way to see that you won't see Taves in a U.S. sweater there.
Well, you wouldn't see Taves in a U.S. sweater.
You wouldn't? Is he a Canadian guy?
Yes, he's a Canadian guy. Now, don't be giving me I grew up a Nashville fan when they've only been there like 8 years. Yes, you ran us out of the playoffs in 4 games last year. Fine. But don't act like you grew up with a hockey team your whole life.
You owed us one after, what, 3 or 4 years ago when we were up 3-1, I guess, and the Hawks came back. But Yeah, no, I mean, I think, honestly, my gut reaction would be the biggest change there would just be ratings. I mean, ratings would be through the roof, although, you know, you've got a big time change difference. So it may not be in prime time or what have you in the United States. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's attention around Olympic hockey when you've got the best players in the world in sort of a different format. Like we said, the optics are different. You don't see ski jumping every day. You don't see luge with people hurtling down a track at 70 miles an hour the other every day. In this instance, you don't get to see all of the best Canadian players. You know, I'm sure they're varying, you know, demonstrations or what have you every once in a while, but you don't see the best Canadian players. You don't see the best U.S. players on ice together. You know, maybe, and even in the All-Star Challenge that changed so much in the NFL or in the NHL, you don't see the best players on the ice competing with each other and against each other all the time. And so I think, to me, that's probably the biggest difference, because the hockey's going to be great. You know, they have some pretty high-level athletes coming from the U.S., so we've heard, albeit they're not household names. But, you know, that's probably the biggest disappointment, I would think, from an Olympic standpoint, is that you're not going to have those big names there. And then certainly I think it hurts the NHL too. I think it's a brand that, you know, it's one of those where you need as much exposure as possible. And that's a shame. And, you know, personally, I would love to see those guys out there.
But, yeah, I agree. I think it's a bad decision overall for the NHL. I don't know all the reasoning behind it. It sounded like it was about insurance and things like that, which I would think the NHL has enough money to cover that. And they were trying to get the Olympic Committee to pony up and things like that. But I do think you're right that the NHL always needs more marketing, especially on a huge international scale like that. And it would be good for them to have their players doing that. I know it messes up the league here for the 1 year, but you would think the international attention would help the league overall. But I would think it might be good, Andrew, for NBC itself, because to me, a lot of the great parts of the Olympic broadcasts are the behind-the-scenes stories of these people, these athletes. And when it's professional players, I don't think those stories are ever as compelling, because these guys are already rich and they've already got this career. And sometimes they've got a great story, but maybe it's already been told. And now you'll have true amateurs again. I would imagine that's what the team is going to be made up of, college kids and upcoming high school kids, things like that. So I think for NBC, you guys will get a little better perspective. And quite honestly, wasn't it the Utah Olympics where our NHL players behaved pretty badly, our U.S. players, after they got eliminated early?
Which was sort of, and I don't remember specifically, I wasn't here. But I do remember, you know, when they came back after Nagano. So I guess Salt Lake would have been the first games, or perhaps they were back, the NHL guys were back in Nagano in 98. But, you're right. And I think that's what the proponents of this have said, is that, wait a second now. You know, and it always has been. We've had the Dream Team. We've had USA Basketball put a bunch of NBA guys out there. That's always been the argument, the counter, right, that this isn't exactly an amateur event. This is more of a spectacle of, you know, the greatest players on earth, including on some exhibition. You know, I think you could make that argument. I would say that the NHL, who seemed to be the party that was more on the side of, well, this is going to mess with us, so we don't want to send them, that could maybe hurt the NHL from a global brand standpoint. But you're right. I think, and, you know, frankly, it's about ratings and exposure with the Olympics as well. And so while, yes, I agree that for sure that's awesome and you'll get some great stories. I'm sure some of these U.S. hockey players are fantastic. And I don't know that they're necessarily a medal favorite, but they'll be there. You know, I think that's great and I think it's awesome. But will that move the needle as far as ratings go? I don't know. But yeah, certainly that's what I love about covering the Olympics, are these sports that we don't see every day and all the great stories that come out of it, just because, I mean, it's what catches our attention when something catches us out of nowhere. So, you know, I'm hoping for the best, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, that's definitely going to be not to say a black eye for these Olympics, but I think it may be something that will get a lot of attention, more so in the fact that the NHL guys are not there rather than the amateur sports angle of it, if I'm trying to make that clear.
What is the time difference in Pyeongchang?
I want to say it's either 14 or 16 hours ahead of us on mountain time. So what's that, just a little bit more for you guys on central time. Yeah, it's something like that, 14, 15, 16 hours, somewhere in there. But the good news is, you know, NBC trying to adapt with the whole social media landscape and, you know, people losing their minds about spoilers and stuff lately.
Yeah.
They're going to do everything across all time zones live. So we're going to have a lot of early mornings and late nights where we're talking about something that's just happened at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's going to be, you know, 6 p.m. the night before here in the States. So
that's really
an interesting coverage aspect, too, from how in the world do we do this.
It's really fun, though, I think, for us viewers to, you know, in the old days when it was, like, basically covered on the wide world of sports, you'd see things in tape delay or you wouldn't know. And it is kind of neat now at 8 in the morning on a day to be able to turn on some event and just have it on. I think it's really cool and it's a lot of fun. So I'm really looking forward to it. Andrew Wittenberg, a news anchor reporter at KSL in Utah, he'll be out in Pyeongchang. And I hope we can talk again, Andrew. I really appreciate you coming on and enlightening us with what you know about these upcoming Olympics. And we'll be following it. We'll check in with you again, okay?
Anytime. Great to chat, man. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Andrew Wittenberg. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook, KSL.com out of Utah. All right. Take a quick break. We'll get to the news next, 720 WGN. (laughs) 3:37 in the morning on WGN Radio. Hello, everybody. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. We're here until 5 in the morning when Orion and Max take over the morning show, enjoying some Papa Nino's pizza during Rogers Newscast.
Good stuff.
I would say thank you, Papa Nino's, but they didn't give it to us for free. I bought it. I was starving for pizza on the way in, Roger, so I started looking up late-night Chicago pizza delivery, and Papa Nino's is open until 3 a.m. on Friday.
I did not know that. And I had the same problem back when I came back to work in... And, you know, the Dominic's, where I used to buy the pizza, closed some time ago. And then I was out for a while, and about when I came back to work about 3 years ago, I started looking for a replacement for them. And there weren't that many close by that were inexpensive like the Dominic's were. Because pizza places around the Tribune Tower, very expensive.
Yeah.
Very expensive.
As you would expect.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Those are where we're at.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's funny, though. You know, it's funny that we're struggling to find a pizza place that delivers at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
As cosmopolitan, as huge of a city as Chicago is, it does relatively close down.
Yeah.
You know, I've gone to New York 4 or 5 times now in my life, and I love staying. Every time I go, I'll stay at the Crown. Is it the Crown Plaza?
I think it's Crown Plaza.
I think it's the Crown Plaza in right down there in Times Square. It's a nice hotel, and it's so close to everything. Like the Ed Sullivan Theater where Colbert is now, where Letterman used to be, is 2 blocks north of there.
Yeah, at the end of one of the shows,
is right across the street.
Don't they say that the guests of one of the shows stay at the Crown Plaza?
Oh, really?
I think I remember. Oh my gosh. I'm trying to remember which show it used to be. I don't think it's one of the ones that are on now. But at the end of the show, they would say, guest of whatever it was, stay at the Crown Plaza Hotel.
And it's not like, you know, it's funny you say that because it's not like the Ritz. It's not, you know, the Four Seasons. It's not insanely over the top awesome. It's nice. It's really nice. It's got a good bar and it's just really close to everything. And so I love staying there, and I stay there every time I go. No matter where I have to be in New York, I stay there. And, you know, sometimes the meetings are in New Jersey, but I stay there because that's where I want to be.
Sure.
And but if you walk out of there on a Wednesday night at 2 in the morning, it looks like Friday night at Chris Kindle Market in Chicago. It's insanity.
Really?
There's so many people everywhere. It's crazy. It's literally crazy.
Now, I've been to New York several times, and I love going to New York. But I have not tried to go there just to experience the nightlife. It's always been like you on business or, you know, there's been an event or this or that. So it's always been kind of a controlled scenario. But is New York considered a 24/7 town?
Absolutely. New York.
Okay.
New York is the city that never sleeps, Roger.
Well, that's true.
Now my experience with it is I'm staying down in Times Square, which is probably the most insane.
Right.
So, like, you know, if I was in a different area of New York City, if I was in Brooklyn or things like that, I'm sure it's more normal. I'm sure,
well, if you were
Times
in more
Square,
of
Manhattan,
a,
or a little more. And I'm sure there's areas of Manhattan that are more of a business district that aren't as crazy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But anytime I'm walking in, I mean, it's amazing. Last time I was there, so at like 4:30 in the afternoon, get off a train at Penn Station, which is where Madison Square Garden is.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to head north about 25 blocks to get to this hotel. So it's a nice, crisp walk. But the mass of humanity, and it's semi-rush hour time, mm-hmm. but the mass of humanity you are walking with and walking into mm-hmm. literally looks like a football stadium let out on both sides of the street, and all these people are headed towards each other.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I've been in that.
And it's a little bit intimidating, but it's energetic as heck, that's mm-hmm. for sure. And it's just, you know, if you haven't ever gone to New York, you got to go to New York just to say, wow, I experienced New York. It's different and it's exciting and it's all these things
mm-hmm.
because I think we think of Chicago, this is a big city, and it is, but it's Chicago, especially after you go to New York, you'll come back and appreciate what a big, small town Chicago is.
Yeah. The roads are better, and believe it or not, the travel, the driving is better in Chicago to get around the city.
It's,
than it is in New York.
Oh, yeah.
New York, we have more room. We have more room. They don't have alleys in New York.
Right. So all the garbage gets piled up on the street.
Exactly.
And then the garbage guy's got to come by and just grab it off the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a lot dirtier. I mean, Chicago's had the great fortune to have burned down once and be rebuilt.
They planned it the right way.
New York didn't get to go through that. So it's really old and rebuilt and really old and rebuilt and very crowded. But it's very cool, too. And it's a lot of fun to go there. So,
yeah.
Do
you see the blue screen on your TV set?
The blue screen on my TV set. The emergency alert system?
Yeah, just went on every channel.
Well, it's supposed to all go on at the same time. We're not worried about that, are we?
No, I'm not worried. It's over.
Has there ever in your career been an actual emergency alert issued? Did we issue one on 9/11? I don't think.
Wow, I don't think there was one. I don't remember hearing one.
I thought there was at some point in our careers, our recent careers, so for me the last 20 years,
mm-hmm.
where we actually did use it once.
I don't remember.
Or was that only in a state, maybe? Or maybe not at all? We never used that thing?
I know there was that snafu that we had a while back where we accidentally triggered one.
Here at
not
GM.
You and I, but...
No. We'd never hear
not that it wouldn't be an un... You know, unexpected thing.
So are we still the lead radio station for it
yes.
in the state?
Yeah.
So as I recall from when I produced here, I believe whenever we would do the test, we started it. And mm-hmm. then like down the line, all the other stations, like our signal goes,
yeah.
sends it out, and then everybody else automatically picks it
well,
up.
Well, they call it EAS now. Used to be EBS.
Okay.
But our EAS triggers all the other EASs.
Okay, and then they
so it's not like someone's sitting at a radio. Every radio station's going, "Hey, look, WGN's playing their EAS."
Right. It
no.
just triggered it.
It triggers it. Yeah.
Well, which is interesting. So were other stations at a disadvantage because we always had ours scheduled.
Right.
So when I was producing a show, we'd be like, "Well, at this time we have this EAS test or EBS test coming mm-hmm. up," and we would know that,
right.
and we would plan for it within the show,
and all
you
the
had
other
to hit
stations
it right on time.
Do it.
Did all the other stations also know
no,
that it
not
was
at
coming?
The same, no, no.
So
every station programs their own at different times, and you're supposed to scatter it around. It's not supposed to be the same day, not supposed to be the same time.
Oh, but I thought ours went off and it triggered everybody else.
No.
Are you sure about
yeah. that? Because I've worked at other radio stations in town.
But that's how it would
state.
Work if it was a true emergency?
If it was a true emergency, it takes over.
Take over their broadcast?
Yeah, right.
But
right.
we don't do that for the
they
tests?
Have to, but they have to test their own individual unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what they do.
I wonder how well prepared we truly are for that. We run this test. We run this recording.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be Wes Bleed, our former newsman, I believe, on it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then what? Because I don't know if any of
then
the broadcasters figure out what happens next.
Then you're supposed to tune to your...
Well, you're apparently tuned to it because you just heard it.
Right.
This is an actual emergency. And do they say?
For the latest in
information. So they always say, in the event of an actual emergency, is there a recording that says, this is an actual emergency?
Well, yeah, right.
And what happens next? Once that tape ends, is it then, I'm Steve Bertrand in the newsroom. We're being bombed by North Korea. And then he is broadcasting on every station in our state?
Yes. Every station that is, part not all stations throughout the state will stay on. Only select ones will stay on.
We'll keep broadcasting
right.
The emergency.
Right. And they will cover the entire state. But yeah, it's always been tested, but never used that I know of. Now, it may have been before I was born and alert enough to know what it was, you know.
I wonder, do you think it's interesting? We were talking just a week or two ago to somebody in Hawaii
because
they tested their nuclear warning system.
Yeah.
And I wonder if our emergency alert system started during the Cold War. I imagine it did, right? When kids were practicing getting under the desks and things like that.
The EBS.
Is that your guess as to when that? And now the librarian will get on his keyboard and type in EBS beginnings.
Let's see here.
On the bonus side, Roger will not cry when he tells us about the history of the emergency broadcast system.
I will not cry.
In the event of an actual emergency.
Don't make me describe another
Roger
movie.
Will start crying.
I won't do that.
And North Korea sending them all. Oh, God. Wouldn't that be the worst if you were...
If I was crying.
You know,
hey,
that's
you
great.
Know what? See, I would not have been the first. Walter Cronkite.
Cried when Kennedy died?
He you could see him and hear him catch.
Well, he takes the glasses off.
Right.
Wipes
and he
away
looks
his
up
tear,
at the
he?
No, he doesn't wipe a tear. He looks up, he starts to choke it up. Mm-hmm. And you can see him kind of wetting his lips because he's trying to choke back the anguish and all this. And he then looks up at the clock. He pauses because he had just said what time the president had been declared dead.
Right.
And then he looks, he takes the glasses off and kind of leans on the desk. And you could see him choke and his eyes kind of blink. And then he picks his head up and looks up at the clock across from him that you can't see as a viewer.
Right.
And he says, so-and-so, our time, Eastern time, about, and then he says about how many minutes ago or something like that. And then he licks his lips. And puts those glasses back on and collects himself and grabs a piece of paper. You watch the video, and I'm telling you exactly what happens. And he grabs the paper, and then he starts talking again.
What about, so that's a famous instance of a broadcaster shedding a tear.
Mm-hmm.
The famous WLS broadcast of the Hindenburg.
Mm-hmm.
He says, oh, the humanity. He sounds a little like he's becoming distraught as
well. You
got to
imagine when you got to remember when that took place. So in the history of broadcasting,
was that 34?
Yeah,
or
that
earlier? Was that even earlier?
God,
you can only look up one thing at a time.
I know.
Did you just skip out on the other one?
It's there. This was 1937. So again, radio was only 15 years old, approximately.
Yeah.
So you're still dealing with a lot of newspaper people.
Yeah.
Who are now
broadcasters.
Broadcasting on radio, and there's no TV. So, I mean, you're getting people who have never done this before, and they're blazing new areas, and the public has never heard anything like this before on the Hindenburg.
Isn't it crazy how when you look back at the history of radio, and we're you know, we read about it or talk about it a little more here because we work here, but you know, so John and I went down to, I believe it's Dayton, Tennessee, on an anniversary of the Scopes Monkey Trial because WGN broadcast that.
That's right.
In 1924,
yep.
I believe, or 25, which was a year into WGN's existence.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about now how we broadcast remote all the time. It's not a big deal. But back then, to broadcast from Dayton, Tennessee back to WGN, it wasn't like we could drive a truck down there and satellite it back up.
Right.
Now, I've always read, and I don't know how true this is, but I've always read that GN had to basically run phone lines down to Dayton.
Yeah.
So that must have been connecting to existing phone lines. They couldn't have run a cable. But you read it as they ran phone lines on like there's
no, it wasn't one whole long cable. No, they ran through the different phone interchanges until they were able to get that. In fact, very famously included in the movie about the Scopes trial, mm-hmm. Inherit the Wind. Mm-hmm. Very important part of that. Movie. So, they would go through the different phone exchanges because there was no clear path. And that was how they, in fact, you know, we still do that today. Now we have all this microwave equipment.
Sure.
So we don't need the wires. But as a backup, we still use all radio stations that do remote broadcast still have a T1 line,
mm-hmm.
which is a clear phone line.
Right.
Independent of everything else. So that's as backup. And I have not heard one have to be used. In fact, TV also uses that. Like if you'll see a TV picture go like a football game or something, mm-hmm. or a baseball game, and suddenly they lose the transmission of the picture.
Right.
And then you suddenly hear like a little click or something, and the audio sounds a little tinnier.
Right.
That's the broadcast line. That's the phone line they're using.
That's a little backup.
As the backup, yeah.
Texter says, you need to go out in the country to a Casey's gas station. The best pizza. Have you ever had a slice from a Casey's?
No, I know about Casey's, and I've been to Casey's.
I see Casey's
I've never
all the time,
pizzas.
And I've stopped in Casey's, yeah. But I agree. I've never tried. I'm a little hesitant on pizza out of a gas station, I got to admit. I've never had a good piece of pizza out of a gas station. I've not tried many.
Right.
Because I hesitate to order hot food at a gas station. Just a general rule.
All right.
I'm sure there's places where it's great.
All right.
But, and then 815 is asking me, is that the same hotel Home Alone 2 is in Lost in New York?
Home Alone 2?
Yeah, he's lost in New York. Actually, Donald Trump makes an appearance, I believe, in the hotel.
Oh, good Lord.
I don't know what hotel that is in. I don't know.
Plaza Hotel.
What's the thing you were looking up before the Hindenburg?
Oh, I'm sorry. The EBS system was established to provide the President of the United States with an expeditious method of communicating with the American public in the event of war, threat of war, or grave national crisis. The EBS replaced the old Conelrad. I remember that one. On August 1963, in later years, it was expanded to use during peacetime emergencies at the state and local levels. Although the system was never used for a national emergency, it was activated more than 20,000 times between 76 and 96 to broadcast civil emergency messages and warnings of severe weather hazards.
Really?
Yeah. So, again, local use.
Well, that's
so
really interesting.
If there's a tornado in Mobile, Alabama,
it kicks off then, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
That would be a really good
right.
use for it.
And they make those radios now.
The weather alert radios?
Yeah.
I have one I can never get to work right, so it sits
what?
In a drawer. I don't know.
Batteries.
I know, it wasn't that. It was like, I don't know. It just tuned in weird or something.
In order to activate the EBS, which is now known as the EAS, Emergency Alert System, mm-hmm. at the national level, would have originated with the president, been relayed via the White House Communications Agency duty officer to one of two origination points, either the Aerospace Defense Command, which I think is in Colorado inside a mountain.
Sounds right.
Or the Federal Preparedness Agency, as the system stood in 78, participating telecommunications, common carriers, radio, TV networks, the Associated Press, United Press International is not around anymore. That's on the list. Would receive and authenticate by means of code words an EAN via an EAN teletypewriter network designed specifically for this purpose. These recipients would relay the EAN to their subscribers and affiliates. Activation procedure. False alarm in 1971. A teletype operator played the wrong tape during a test.
Whoops.
Yep. And authenticated the code words through the entire system, ordering stations to cease regular programming and broadcast alert of a national emergency. A cancellation message was sent at 9:59. The activation was at 9:33.
Ooh, that's 26 minutes.
Yeah.
Of emergency. Now, what did those stations do? And what got broadcast, or was it dead air? Well, how bad would that freak you out?
Oh, horribly.
This is an actual emergency. Stay tuned for the latest information.
Wow.
And then nothing.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, what is happening?
False alarm demonstrated major flaws in the system. Many stations had not received the alert, but more importantly, the vast majority of those that did either ignored it because it came at the time of a scheduled test or did not know what to do in an emergency. Some
and
stations,
that's what I'm saying. We'd be like right now, there'd be an emergency, and we'd go, oh, never expected it to be an actual emergency.
Right, because it was a scheduled test.
Well, even if it wasn't, Raj, what if one went off right now?
No one would.
What would you and I do?
You would have to take
over and start telling us what's going on.
I would. I probably would. Like, well, first of all,
everybody, it's an actual emergency.
I would go
emergency.
To the bomb shelter first.
And you then, can't do that.
Then lock the
you
door.
You got to stay where you're at.
You would have the pizza outside the door.
That's why you're up on the seventh floor.
No, I need to be in the bomb shelter.
No. You got to be up. Up above.
Estimated only 20% of the stations followed the procedures completely. While several stations went off the air, the one best remembered was WOWO in Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's your home state.
Whoa.
Which broadcasts the 1971 events as they happen, a recording of which has become available. We'll have to find that.
What were the events?
Just of the alerts and stuff.
The accidental?
Yeah, the alerts. Another recording of how the error sounded on WCCO. Wasn't that John's
That's
old
John's station?
That's John's station
up in Minnesota.
Yeah, can be heard on radiotapes.com.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to catch up on some spots after the 4 a.m. news, which Roger will do in a few minutes. We're going to talk about daylight savings time. Some states are trying to separate from it. What do you think? Should we? We'll chat about this a little bit. Should we stick with it? Should we move away from it altogether? We'll chat about that after the news next, 720 WGN. Thank you, Roger. Matt Bobala here with you, everybody. Here till 5 in the morning. 720 WGN, thanks for hanging out with us. Going to get a little warm today, 45 degrees, Roger was saying. Mm-hmm. It was actually a lot cooler. You know, it wasn't bad as I headed in tonight. It was a lot warmer than it's been.
Yeah. It's been warming up during the day, even though earlier yesterday the wind was pretty cutting.
A little whippy.
Yeah.
And down on the United Nations Plaza or whatever we call this across the street here by the...
Well, that's right, across the street.
Yeah, across the street. We got all those flags and a little plaza out there. And it looks like a statue of Mussolini or something. I don't know
what
that
is. No, it's not Mussolini.
It looks like some dictator, though, doesn't it? Yeah, have you ever looked at that statue across the street?
I've looked at it, but not intently.
Like Stalin or something.
No, it's
not. I'm sure it's not. I'm just saying it looks like it.
Maybe it's Balbo.
Wasn't there a thing about bringing Balbo down earlier this year?
Yeah. Getting rid of it and everything.
Because it was a gift from Mussolini or something crazy like that, right?
Yeah.
Anywho.
Well, they flew their planes here, remember?
Yeah. Well, no, I wasn't around for that.
Well, gonna hurt you.
Anywho, the wind is blowing across the street, although it looks a little bit nicer. You were saying that it'd be here's your last real chance to maybe get your lights up if you didn't do it when it was 60 degrees the day after Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you didn't do it
then.
Well,
I think the normal high for this time of year is about 36 degrees, so
sounds about
it'll
right.
be about 10 degrees higher.
It felt cold this week, and I know I'm getting older, and I hate that I'm like this now, but God, do I hate the cold now.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid, I loved going out and skating at the park and doing all this stuff and just running around, and now my high school-age son shows up every day without a coat on after school. I'm like, where the hell is your coat?
I left it in my locker.
Jack, God sakes, it's freezing out there. And it doesn't, you know, tonight I'm out walking the dog. He's heading down to his buddy's house down the street wearing a sweatshirt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, get in the house and put a damn jacket on. What is wrong with you? But they're not cold. We get old. I guess our blood thins and we get cold. And now every year, man, I'm thinking, when are we going to Mexico? How can I start working for Mexico? What can we do to not be here in the winter?
Get on XTRA.
I keep telling Colleen that, like, from Thanksgiving to, like, tax day, you just go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Come back for 2 weeks at Christmas, because then you reappreciate the cold and see family and then want to get out again.
Yeah.
I think that would be the way to do it. So tonight, I put up the Christmas lights. I did all of that right after Thanksgiving, the next day. And it was
awesome.
You were
all done.
I was done. Except, so we have several evergreen little bushes out in front of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then our little walkway. We have a porch on the house. And then, so on the threshold, we usually buy some like real garland. you know, like balsam, Douglas fir, whatever, Fraser fir. Mm-hmm. And so we went and bought it last weekend, and then I didn't get it out. So then tonight, I draped it. What I normally do is I hang it, because we got some nails that stick out up there, and I hang it across the way.
Sure.
And then I'll wrap lights around it while it's hanging.
Oh, okay.
But it's all so cold right now that I didn't really want to stand there trying to do that.
Right.
So I draped it over two ladders in the garage, and I started wrapping it in there. And I was very proud of myself because I did it all in there and I got it looking good. But then I had to drag it out to the threshold, and it's 25 feet of garland. So it's
and
a lot.
Lights.
And with the lights wrapped around it. So I drag it over there. I get out the ladder on my ice-covered step.
Oops.
And I get up there and I hang it and I get it to hang and I plug it in. And it looks awesome, except for about a two-foot section where it's completely black because the lights are partially out on a strand.
Oh, no.
I'm like, doggone it. Because it worked in the garage, and then probably as I was dragging, I dislodged something else. So my little Lightkeeper Pro is going to get a test tomorrow. Let's see if you can fry that baby back
nice.
Up.
Oh, nice.
Lightkeeper Pro, I don't know if they're advertising this year. I know they often advertise on Lou's show.
Yeah, they were.
Like that.
They were advertising earlier.
Good.
Yeah.
Friends of Lightkeeper Pro.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, people, I bought one of those things a couple years ago. I don't know how the hell it works. I don't know why it works.
Mm-hmm.
It's some weird voodoo. But you unplug a light. You shove it into the socket on this gun. It looks like a little gun. And then you squeeze the trigger a million times. And somehow, all the lights light up. Generally.
Wow.
Doesn't always work.
I need to go get one.
I don't know what it is. Like, it's sending electrical currents through the lines and clearing the... It's like it's unclogging your arteries or something.
Well, if you're squeezing the thing 100,000 times, something's got to happen.
Or nothing could happen.
Or your arm falls off.
I guess. I don't understand it. It's like beyond the role of realm of physics in my world that I can understand why this works, but somehow it generally works. So I'm going to have to pull out that Lightkeeper Pro tomorrow and see if we can fire these babies back up. Or else I got to take a strand down. That's going to suck. But at least it'll be warm enough to do it.
But do it before Sunday because you might have some rain somewhere.
45 is not exactly warm. It's going to feel warm because it's been so cold.
But you don't have to drag out the Nanook of the North jacket like I do.
That's true. I do not. Although I wouldn't mind. I do like the Nanook of the North look. Okay, let's talk about this for a minute.
Yes.
I meant to talk about this last weekend. This is a story from a couple of weeks ago from WTHR in Indianapolis. They write, Indiana's decision a decade ago to observe daylight savings time continues to be a controversial one, and now lawmakers in other states are starting to question if daylight savings time is really in everyone's best interests. A state senator in Florida filed a bill this year that would move that state onto standard time year-round. A lawmaker in Texas did the same. A state representative in South Carolina wants to put the question to voters on the November 2018 ballot. Massachusetts and Maine are taking it a step further. Not only do they want to drop daylight savings time, they also want to jump ahead an hour year-round by moving from Eastern time to Atlantic time. So instead of being 1 hour ahead of us, Massachusetts and Maine would be 2 hours ahead of us.
What? That's crazy. I'm sorry.
That was interesting. Both states and New England as a whole have been working to... It's a very interesting reason why, Roger. Why do you think they want to move another hour ahead?
First voting.
Nope. Although that's interesting.
An hour ahead of Eastern time. Why would... An extra hour of sunlight? No.
Why? Why would
voting,
they want that, though?
Voting, sunlight... Oh, the tourist season.
No. What seems to be the consternation that everybody has in the world? How do we make who happy?
My wife?
That's your consternation in the world. And while all men have that individual consternation, as a whole, who do we see more concerned about pleasing these days? Jess, I bet you know. Jess, who do we need to turn on your microphone? Who are we looking to please these days?
I got nothing.
Come on. You know who it is.
President Trump.
No. Jess. You're one of them.
A millennial?
Millennials.
Why do we have to make them happy?
Here's what it says. New England as a whole have been working to attract more millennials. But leaders tell the Wall Street Journal that millennials consistently complain about how early it gets dark there during the winter months. Officials hope the time zone switch would help solve that problem.
Oh, come on. We give them everything already, and now we have to change the clocks just for them?
It's a legit issue. It sucks Listen, if you are far on that coast,
mm-hmm.
so think about how far Eastern Time goes. Detroit's on Eastern Time. Just right. outside of Northwest Indiana was on Eastern Time not that long ago. That is a wide swath,
it
right?
is.
If you're all the way on the most eastern part of that, it gets darkest earliest.
Well, of course.
So if here, where we're sort of on the edge of Central Time,
mm-hmm.
right? We're on the easternish
eastern edge
of Central
right.
Time.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting dark here in the winter, in the dead of winter, about 4:30,
yeah,
right?
Before that sometimes.
Okay,
yeah,
so think about if you're all the way the other side of that, there. So there, yeah, so it's about the same thing for them. So it's getting,
still more light on the western edge of the central
on
time.
On the western edge.
Right.
So they're all the way on the eastern edge and maybe a little further than we
so
are.
So you're saying cut down the eastern time zone, split it in half, and
well,
get,
they want to jump onto the Atlantic time zone
right.
so that instead of it getting, maybe it's getting dark there at 4 or 3:30,
mm-hmm.
it's more like 5 o'clock at night,
right.
a more normal issue.
Right.
And I could... I'm okay with that. When I lived in Detroit for a year. I produced for Danny Bonaducci and worked at the mm-hmm. sports station out there. And it was, I was there from October to September. And in late summer, I guess I wasn't there in late summer. I got there in October. Or maybe when I went to interview, it was like August or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here, dead of summer, I remember as a child, we would play ball tag in the neighborhood.
Sure, till about 9:30.
Have to wait till it got dark.
Yeah.
It would be after 9 o'clock at night when it really was dark enough
right.
that nobody could see each other. In Detroit, it was like dusk until almost 10 o'clock at night.
Mm.
It was crazy how late it was light out.
Because they were on the
Because they're so
western
far
edge.
West yeah. of that time zone. So I could really see where it does affect, and you'd think about, well, if we change this, we'll get more workers here. It helps the economy. Why not? It'd be darker in the morning. I don't mind the darkness in the morning, though. I like when it's dark when I have to drive in. People drive better. One of the worst things that can happen to a morning commute, if you ask me, is the sun coming up. Because certain times of the year, it's blinding. It just
right.
doesn't help. I think the darkness and the streetlights being on makes for a better commute.
Hmm. In the morning.
Yeah, in the morning. I think it's just easier on people. That sun comes up, it's over the horizon, it kind of gets in the eyes, it starts slowing
Use
people down.
Use your visor.
Roger.
I know. I'm sorry.
Indiana has a long, complicated, and emotion-filled history with daylight saving time. Under state law, most of Indiana ignored it from the early 1970s until the spring of 2005. During that period, 77 counties were in Eastern time with New York, but never changed their clocks, which meant their clocks matched Chicago and Central Time during daylight savings time.
Mm.
Five counties were on Eastern Time, but unofficially observed daylight savings time, which meant they stayed with New York year-round. 10 were on Central Time and officially observed daylight savings time, which meant they stayed with Chicago year-round. So Indiana was all over the map.
Yeah. By the way, take the S off of savings.
Why? So it is written correctly here, but I say daylight savings time.
I know. Most people do. But it's daylight saving time.
Because we're saving daylight. We're
right.
not savings daylight.
And we're not burning daylight as...
I think it's daylight savings
John
time.
John Wayne used to say.
Why can't it just be daylight savings time?
Because it's not.
Hmm. Hmm. What if I apply for official change of that?
I think you should.
In fact, I'm writing on my paper right now an apostrophe S. Because it's not plural. It's possessive in my world.
But you're saving the daylight. You're not saving the savings. You're saving daylight. You're not saving.
Well, if it's apostrophe S, I'm not saving savings. I'm possessing the time for savings.
You're not possessing anything. You're possessing the saving. Not
then
the
Governor Mitch Daniels pushed the move for the entire state to officially observe daylight saving time. You're welcome. Saying it would end confusion and promote commerce. Lawmakers passed the measure by a single vote in an emotional debate.
Ooh.
I didn't know that. At the time, 18 counties asked the U.S. Department of Transportation to put them in the central time zone to be aligned with Chicago year-round. 8 of the counties were granted permission, but the other 10 were left in eastern time with New York, leaving 18 total Indiana counties on central time and 74 on eastern. But they all now observe daylight saving time.
Thank you.
What do you think, Rod? Should we get rid of daylight saving time?
You know what? I never thought of it before. I mean, I have, but never
You've heard
in
the
this
debate come up,
right? I But I never thought of... I realized that cities on the western edge of a time zone would have more daylight later in the day, though less daylight at the beginning of the day.
Right.
Just, it's basic science.
Sure.
But I never thought that it would affect business or education or any of those other entities in this way, that that's what is causing this debate. I could see that the states under the Eastern time zone, I could see that being split in half. It's huge. It really is. Maybe they just decided to be greedy and decided to grab it all for themselves. I don't know.
George Hudson proposed the idea of daylight saving in 1895. The German Empire and Austria-Hungary organized the first nationwide implementation starting on April 30th, 1916. Many countries have used it at various times since then, particularly since the energy crisis of the 1970s. Generally not observed near the equator, when sunrise times do not vary enough to justify it. Some countries observe it only in some regions. For example, southern Brazil observes it while equatorial Brazil does not. Only a minority of the world's population uses DST because Asia and Africa generally do not observe it. DST clock shifts sometimes complicate timekeeping and can disrupt travel, billing, record-keeping, medical devices, heavy equipment, and sleep patterns. Computer software often adjusts clocks automatically, but policy changes by various jurisdictions of DST dates and timings may be confusing.
See, I don't like it because of the changing the clocks. It takes forever to get in sync with the new times. I hate it. I really do. I never have liked it.
Well, your phone does it automatically now. You just got your car and
the
your...
The phone doesn't have a brain and legs and arms. I'm sorry.
Huh?
It's a human being thing that I'm talking about.
Oh, you can't adjust to the hour?
I even turn the clocks ahead like 6 hours before.
You do it before you go to bed then?
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to have your body adjust, right?
But it's still
1 hour. How tough is it to adjust to 1 hour?
The older you get.
Yeah, but the one of them, you get an extra hour of sleep.
Doesn't matter.
It's like a winning the lottery.
I stress out ahead of time to make sure I still get up on time. So I lose the hour of sleep because I'm stressing. I have stresses in my life.
God, Roger. While the times of sunrise and sunset change at roughly equal rates as the seasons change, proponents of DST argue that most people prefer a greater increase in daylight hours after the typical 9-to-5 workday. Supporters have also argued that DST decreases energy consumption by reducing the need for lighting and heating, but the actual effect on overall energy use is heavily disputed. The manipulation of time at higher latitudes has little impact on daily life because the length of day and night changes more extremely throughout the seasons, and the sunrise and sunset times are significantly out of phase with standard working hours regardless of manipulations of the clock.
Well, so do we have to have then different time zones, not just from ocean to ocean, but from ocean level to mountain level?
Modern DST was first proposed by the New Zealand entomologist George Hudson, whose shift work job gave him leisure time to collect insects and led him to value after-hours daylight. In 1895, he presented a paper to the Wellington Philosophical Society proposing a 2-hour daylight-saving shift, and after considerable interest was expressed in Christ Church, he followed up in an 1898 paper. Many publications credit DST proposal to the prominent English builder and outdoorsman William Willett, who independently conceived DST in 1905 during a pre-breakfast ride when he observed with dismay how many Londoners slept through a large part of a summer day. An avid golfer, he also disliked cutting short his round at dusk. His solution was to advance the clock during the summer months, a proposal he published 2 years later. The proposal was taken up by the Liberal Member of Parliament, blah, 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 blah. So I don't quite understand. Was the original plan... I always thought the whole point of daylight saving time was to give an earlier start to the day for farmers. So that's not really
right,
true.
Right, that's what
it?
I thought. No, no,
it's,
and
it's,
I
it's
have thought that for decades.
To give more light later in the day?
According to what you just read, it's like more light at the end of the day to collect bugs.
became widely adopted, particularly in North America and Europe, starting in the 1970s as a result of the 1970s energy crisis.
That I remember. There was a lot of changing, especially in Indiana, when the energy crisis came in. They started having more debates about the changing of the hours because of that, because they wanted to save energy. So they figure if you could have light out more, longer.
So more light later in the day, saved us energy?
Well, yeah, because you wouldn't need your lights, you wouldn't need a heater, you wouldn't need air conditioning, you know, that stuff. I don't think anything came of it. I would have to look at the studies, but I'll bet you now that it didn't make a difference.
U.S. retailing and manufacturing interests led by Pittsburgh industrialist Robert Garland soon began lobbying for DST, but were opposed by railroads. The U.S.'s 1917 entry into the war overcame objections, and DST was established in 1918. The war's end swung the pendulum back. Farmers continued to dislike DST, and many countries repealed it after the war. Britain was an exception. It retained DST nationwide, but over the years adjusted transition dates for several reasons, including special rules during the 1920s and 30s to avoid clock shifts on Easter mornings.
Well, now that's a religious thing.
Only a few U.S. cities retained DST locally thereafter, including New York, so that its financial exchanges could maintain an hour of arbitrage trading with London, and Chicago and Cleveland to keep pace with New York. Wilson's successor, Warren G. Harding, opposed DST as a, quote, deception, reasoning that people should instead get up and go to work earlier in the summer. Reasoning that people should get up and go to work earlier in the summer, he ordered District of Columbia federal employees to start work at 8 o'clock rather than 9 o'clock during summer 1922. Some businesses followed suit, though many others did not. The experiment was not repeated. The history of time in the United States includes DST during both world wars, but no standardization of peacetime DST until 1966. In May 1965, for 2 weeks, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Minneapolis, Minnesota were on different times when the capital city decided to join most of the nation by starting daylight saving time, while Minneapolis opted to follow the later date set by state law. In the mid-1980s, Clorox and 7-Eleven provided the primary funding for the Daylight Saving Time Coalition behind the 1987 extension to USDST, and both Idaho senators voted for it based on the premise that during DST, fast food restaurants sell more French fries, which are made from Idaho potatoes. And that's one to grow on. All right, 4:30 in the morning. Let's get upstairs and check the headlines, Mr. Battish. Got about 24 minutes left in the show this morning. Only two more shows left this year, Roger Battish.
Oh my goodness. Oh my think goodness. Oh my that. Goodness. You're going to be here for...
I think I'm going to be here for all of them.
Okay, good, 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 good.
I don't have any plans.
Yeah, I like this, like the second year, second or third year in a row that the holidays have been on the weekend, so I've been working.
Yeah. So. And let's see, we'll be on... Because we usually go into tape programming for about a day here at GM, but that won't start until
I think it starts like 6 p.m.
on Saturday night.
Yeah, and then goes till
Sunday night.
About 6 p.m. on Sunday. I think we got a game at 6 p.m. on Sunday.
Is that a Hawks game?
I'm not sure. I'll have to double check.
Because Northwestern plays on Friday, I want to say, right?
Yeah, let me...
Well, that's after Christmas, so that's not until the 29th. Northwestern's bowl game.
Hold on a second. I'm pulling up the schedule right now. This is for Christmas Day. So let's see here, 24th. So on the 24th, we have programming. I was right. It starts at 6. Actually, we've got Hampton will be with Cause from 3 to 6 on that day. That's Christmas Eve.
That's right, because the Bears played noon
right.
that day.
And then...
what will be one of the greatest Bears tilts of all time, the Christmas Eve matchup.
Uh-huh.
When the Cleveland Browns come to town for a noon game on Christmas Eve. Tickets have been found on StubHub for as low as $13. It will cost you more to park at Soldier Field than to attend the game that day, if you so desire.
Actually, no, we don't have a... there is no game on Monday, Christmas Day. We just go right into the download.
What's your guess? What's your guess on the number of no-shows I'm assuming that Bears game is sold out. So let's assume, say, 60,000 tickets are sold.
You think it's already a sold out?
Generally, all the Bear games are sold out. Oh, I mean, they're all on TV. Okay. So let's say it's sold out.
All right.
But most people don't want to go because it's Christmas Eve. They got stuff to do with their family. Yeah. The game is not worth
nothing. Probably going to be freezing, and it doesn't mean anything, yeah. And they're losing anyway.
And you got all this family to prepare for, yeah. To cook or to whatever.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
It's a big day for a no-show.
And you got WGN radio to listen to.
You got that.
Yeah.
So how many people?
Oh, I'd say maybe. I'll say 40% don't show up.
So out of 60,000, you'll say up to 15,000 don't show up.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be 25%.
Well,
you'll say up
40,
to 20,000. No, yeah. You said 40%.
Yeah, 40%.
25,000.
Mm-hmm.
That would be something.
That's a big
I think
chunk.
You might not be wrong, especially if the weather's iffy at all.
See, I don't
especially
know what it's been.
Especially if it's rainy or something.
Have they filled the stadium the last 3-4 home games?
I'm sure they have. I'm sure there have been some no-shows and maybe a decent amount, but...
Mm-hmm. But not that many.
Not that many. I mean, there at least is some hope with Mitchell Trubisky starting now and stuff like that. I think there's some interest in that, and you know.
Yeah, but the season's over. There's no postseason.
Well, the season's definitely over.
Yeah.
But often the Bears season is over about 4 or 5 games in. So even if they were going to squeak into the playoffs, it's not like they were going to make a run on it or anything. Yeah. So 25,000 no-shows. Wouldn't that be something?
Oh, you know what I was thinking of? I was thinking of New Year's Eve. We have a Hawks game.
Oh, are they at home or away?
Away at Calgary.
Hawks get to spend New Year's Eve in Calgary.
Yeah, and then Steve and Johnny on right after it to ring in the new year again.
They're going to do their overnight
Yes, New Year's they
Eve.
Are.
Oh, that's cool.
And so I will be here with them.
Oh, cool.
Again, and they're going to have another great show.
Just like old times.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds very cool.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Great times here at WGN on the holidays. We love doing it. We love being there for everybody.
Everybody will be here to take everybody into 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Orion will take us into the morning coming up in a little bit. This week on Chicago's Best, Brittany and Elliot are shining a light on all those who give back. It's an all-new Chicago's Best Giving Back, Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV. Matt Bubala here with you for 20 more minutes on 720 WGN.
Like that,
that is a nice song. 312-981-7200 is the phone and text line. So, Roger, I was saying at the beginning of the show, on Thursday night, late Thursday night, after the school Christmas program, we took the children, as has become, this is our third year in a row, the night of the school Christmas program has been the opening night of Disney's Star Wars movie. Last year it was Rogue One.
Right.
The year before that it was The Force Awakens.
Right.
And this year it was The Last Jedi.
So you saw it already.
Third year in a row we went and saw it opening night.
Nice.
This was a 10:15 showing.
You ordered your tickets online?
Ordered the tickets.
Okay.
I almost always do now because we tend to go to these theaters that have the reserved seating.
Okay. All
and right. If you don't order ahead of time, the theaters tend to be smaller with the reserved seating because the seats are big.
Right.
These recliners, which are nice.
Yeah.
I do like it. But it is kind of a pain in the butt because it's a little less easy to last minute decide to go and just get in line. Although I like that I know where my seat's going to be.
Right.
Because there's nothing worse than going to a theater and then getting there a little late and it's a more crowded show than you expected and suddenly you're craning your neck sitting in that front row.
And if you got more than one and you have one person sitting in the 10th row on the left side, another person.
There's six of us.
Yeah,
so,
oh God.
So even with this, we did a three and three. Three of us were in front of each other because by the time I was ordering the tickets, you know, we could have gone to earlier showings, things like that, but we would have been stuck way up front. And I wanted to, you know, have a decent seat. So went to the 10:15 showing.
Yeah.
And after the 20 minutes of previews, it's about 10:40. 10:35 when the movie actually starts, and it's a 2.5-hour movie.
Wow.
Yeah. So we got out at 1 in the morning.
Oh my gosh. You wish you had that hour back, huh?
I needed daylight savings time. Daylight savings time would have kicked in that night. I could have got an extra hour of sleep, maybe. But, so Friday morning, everybody in our house was a mess.
I can imagine.
And I had to bring... Did I mention on the radio that we got a dog? Have we talked
about this? Yes, you did. I think last week you mentioned
it. So little Bailey, our mini golden doodle, because he's so brand new and not used to spending time alone, if I'm headed down to work, I bring him with me.
Oh,
because the kids are at school, Colleen is teaching, and I feel bad leaving this. You know, we don't want to leave the dog alone, so he comes down a black dog with me, and so that's fun and interesting and a mess because you know we're still potty training, and it's a lot tougher downtown because there's no grass to take him out on.
Ooh.
I got like three trees on the sidewalk out inside that he's training to, and he's peeing pretty good on them, but the pooping is another story.
Yeah,
so he likes to leave little presents around black dog.
Keep you on your toes.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. And yeah, because I have washed off my shoe once already from stepping in it. Yeah. That's no fun. But so we saw the movie, and it was, you know, it's interesting. So the critical reviews were all really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
Now I just saw a headline tonight here that on, is it Rotten Tomatoes? It got a worse review than Justice League.
Wow.
From fans.
And Justice League wasn't that
great. No, Justice League was awfully reviewed. I'm now reading a story about upcoming movie release dates. And this is interesting. James Cameron recently revealed that Avatar 2 is scheduled for December 18th, 2020.
Again?
They already know the date it's coming out, December 18th, 2020.
But that's been moved a couple of times.
That will be 11 years after the first one, followed by Avatar 3, 4, and 5 in 2021, 2024, and 2025. They've already announced the dates. And you know, that's a pretty gutsy move, saying I'm going to make three more Avatar movies, considering, I know it's crazy, I've never seen Avatar.
The first biggest, one made a ton of
it's
money.
It's the biggest movie of all time.
Yeah, I didn't pay much for it.
Yet nobody's ever been demanding a sequel. It was an article earlier this year, last year, that we talked about here on the show, that there's no cultural reference ever to Avatar. Star Wars is such a part of our culture. Yeah. Star Trek is such a part of our culture. So many things are. Avatar is not.
Yeah. In fact, at least in my circles, if you say Avatar now,
I don't
think it's a computer figure.
Yeah, I agree. Not to be outdone, Disney, which boasts the third highest grossing worldwide movie ever in Star Wars The Force Awakens, which trails behind Cameron's Titanic and Avatar, announced on Tuesday that Colin Trevorrow's Star Wars Episode 9 is scheduled for May 24th, 2019, which is a slight surprise considering The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi were both December releases. But Disney probably doesn't want to compete against itself because your kids will demand to take them to see Frozen 2 on November 27th. 2019. Also on the schedule,
Indiana Jones wants to see Frozen 2.
Well, all the kids, all the little kids.
You know what? My little kids who used to sing it in their sleep,
they
can't stand it anymore.
Also on the schedule, Indiana Jones 5, which had its release date pushed back from July 19th, 2019, because that's when Jon Favreau's The Lion King remake will now come out. Also out in 2019, Toy Story 4 and Avengers Infinity War Part 2.
Oh, well, there you go. There's your blockbuster.
So Indiana Jones 5 is now on July 10th, 2020. Harrison Ford will be nearly 80 years old.
Jesus. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Does he get to fly a plane in this one?
I don't know about that. I think they're trying to get him to stop doing that.
Wow. So
it will be interesting to see how The Last Jedi does, because it was, I think it's really well acted. I think they have a lot of good characters. They have a good script. It has pretty funny moments in it. One of the problems I do have with these new Star Wars movies is sometimes some characters you get kind of excited about and then they're gone.
Right.
Two examples from the past were Boba Fett, who's one of the all-time favorite characters.
Right, he was
from Star Wars. He's barely in any of the movies. He makes, he's in Empire Strikes Back, and then he's in Return of the Jedi, but they kill him off pretty early in Return of the Jedi. He's not in a lot. Darth Maul was probably, in my mind, the best thing out of the new trilogy, the ones that came out in the 90s,
1, 2, 3.
Late 90s. And he gets killed off in that movie pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I think that was a mistake. And in the cartoons, they've brought him back. He survives that.
He's sliced in half.
He's sliced in half. So in the cartoons, he's got a mechanical bottom half of his body.
Oh, jeez.
And I think there's rumors and people wonder if his character will be brought back in some way in these movies.
God. Wait, there's one more
same thing
left,
with,
right? I'm losing
in this trilogy,
count.
Yes, there will be one more trilogy.
So the story's not over yet.
This story is not over yet. Okay. And another trilogy has already been announced that will be completely separate from this 9-episode
Right, in a different part of the galaxy
or
universe.
Or something along
somewhere.
Those lines.
Right, right, right.
but in this as well, there have been two characters that... that are, and I won't talk about them yet.
But don't.
Two characters who I'm disappointed that I feel like, come on, don't introduce these characters and get us excited and then just, you know, they're done already. It's frustrating.
We'll see.
So are you going to go see the movie?
You know what? We're kind of like what you just talked about last minute thing with my schedule, which basically only gives me one day off. And not knowing from day to day Bridget's health, whether she's got enough strength to...
Would Bridget go see it? Would she want to see it?
I think she would. She's gone with me to see the Marvel superhero ones. She loved the Wonder Woman one. She thought it was great.
I loved the Wonder Woman movie. It was awesome.
Yeah. So, because she likes going out on dates with me because we so rarely go out.
Sure.
But, again, it's just, and we would do things kind of at a last minute. And it's usually me, like, okay, I know I don't have to work tonight. I know I don't have the kids tonight. I don't feel like cooking. I know you don't have you don't feel like cooking. Come on. Change your clothes. Let's go. We're going. I'll go on the phone and check the time and we'll probably eat at one of the Let Us Entertain You chain restaurant places that's near the theater.
So you need to let this one die down a little bit then so that people aren't, right? You got to let the first weekend pass on the Star Wars movie.
I don't do that by choice.
Yeah.
I just, it's by the time we get around.
Right.
Find
the opening time.
Yeah, right.
Well, I'll be interested to hear what you think of it. There was a long preview. Well, for the next,
they've gotten rid of it. They got rid of the Frozen preview.
That was before Coco. Is that what you're talking about?
Oh no, I thought there was a.
No, there was the. I think the story you're talking about is, so when Pixar releases their films, there's almost always a short film that plays before,
right?
And Coco is the new Pixar movie that's out that's getting really rave reviews.
Right.
And there was a, like, 20-minute... What's the snowman guy?
It's Frozen. Oh, Olaf.
Olaf. There was an Olaf mini-movie that was playing before it.
And people couldn't stand it.
Well, so there was. It was interesting the way it's been spun. The articles were like they yanked it, because it was so long. It was 20 minutes long. Usually those short films are about 7 or 8 minutes.
Right.
This was 20 minutes long. So once you do the 20 minutes of previews, then you do this 20-minute film, you're 40 minutes in before your kids are seeing the Coco movie.
Yeah.
But Disney insists that it was always a short, it was a certain amount of time Coco was out, this preview was going to be before it. That it wasn't... It was
so they had planned it not
They're
to
saying
be,
it's not because people were complaining. It's because it was a limited run.
Sure,
so
right.
who knows on sure. that. But right. no, we saw a long trailer for a Jurassic Park, the next Jurassic Park, which looks pretty good.
Yeah.
The first one I thought was good. But your Infinity War movie that's coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Your Avengers
Number
Infinity
one.
War.
Yeah.
And I thought it looked pretty good.
Okay.
And I don't understand. I know you understand your whole thing that you got going on there with this, and I don't understand who all's in this universe, who all's in that universe, or what the hell the deal is.
Right, right, right.
But what was interesting to me is they do all the saying and the Hulk and the guy and the Iron Man and whoever and Scarlett Johansson and all these people. And then at the very end of the preview, which is a pretty long trailer, at the very end of the preview, one of the guys looking at the camera goes, "Who the heck are you?" And then it flashes to Chris Pratt and the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
I didn't even know they're tied into any of this.
Oh, yeah, they are. It's part of the Marvel Universe.
So that'll be their first time joining this gang, right?
Well, joining this gang, but it's their
I know they've
their
had
third
films
movie.
Out. I know they've had films out.
Yeah, it'll be their
out.
Third
yeah.
film.
Yeah. yeah. So I thought that was kind of cool.
But see, the people on Earth, the superheroes on Earth, don't know anything about the Guardians of the Galaxy because they're out in space. They have not been to Earth except for Chris Pratt's character, who was born on Earth but was taken away when he was about, I want to say, maybe 9 or something okay. like that, 10.
So you've got that to look forward yeah. to. All yeah. right, we got to take a break. We'll say hi to Orion in a minute here on 720 WGN. Texter from 331 says, I manage a movie theater. Before Coco was released, Disney gave us advance notice that Olaf's Frozen Adventure would only run the first 2 weeks. So there you go. Oh, Disney's okay. got some backup on that. News gotcha. Coming up. Thanks for being with us, everybody. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Bubala. On Facebook, give a like to the Matt Bubala Show.